you without choice, without consent. It is so in this, elven girl. You are the last of the chosen. You are the last real hope of the elves. You cannot run away from it. You cannot hide from it. You most certainly cannot change it. Amberley rose, paced away a step, and turned. You do not understand. Alanon watched her. I understand better than you think. If you did, you would not ask me to return. When I left Arbalon, I knew that I would never go back again. In the eyes of my mother, my grandfather, and my people, I had disgraced myself. I did something that could not be forgiven. I rejected the gift of being a chosen. Even should I wish it, and I do not, this cannot be undone. The elves are a people whose sense of tradition and honor runs deep. They can never accept what has happened. If it were made known to them that they would all perish from the earth unless I alone chose to save them, still they would not have me back. I am outcast from them, and that will not change. The druid rose and faced her, tall and black as he towered over her small form. His eyes were frightening as they fixed on hers. Your words are foolish ones, elven girl. Your arguments are hollow, and you speak them without conviction. They do not become you. I know you to be stronger than what you have shown. Stung by the reprimand, Amberley went taut. What do you know of me, druid? You know nothing. She stepped close to him, green eyes filled with anger. I am a teacher of children. Some of them you saw this night. They come in groups of half a dozen or eight and stay with me one season. They are given into my care by their parents. They are entrusted to me. While they are with me, I give to them my knowledge of living things. I teach them to love and to respect the world into which they were born, the land and sea and sky and all that lives upon and within it. I teach them to understand that world. I teach them to give life back in exchange for the life they were given. I teach them to grow and nurture that life. We begin simply, as with this garden. We finish with the complexity that surrounds human life. There is love in what I do. I am a simple person with a simple gift, a gift I can share with others. A chosen shares nothing with others. I was never a chosen, never. That was something I was called upon to be that I did not wish to be, nor was suited to be. All that I have left behind me. I have made this village and its people my life. This is who I am. This is where I belong. Perhaps. The druid's voice was calm and steady, and it brushed aside her anger. Yet will you turn your back on the elves for no better reason than this? Without you, they will surely perish. They will stand and fight as they did in the old world when the evil first threatened. But this time they lack the magic to make them strong. They will be destroyed. These children have been given into my keeping, the girl began hurriedly, but Alanon's hand rose abruptly. What do you think will happen once the elves are destroyed? Do you think the evil ones will be content to stay within the borders of the Westland? What of your children then, elven girl? Amberley stared at him wordlessly for a moment, then dropped slowly back down onto the bench. Tears ran again from her eyes, and she closed them tightly. Why was I chosen? She asked softly, her words barely more than a whisper. There was no reason for it. I did not seek it. And there were so many others who did. Her hands clenched in her lap. It was a mockery, druid. A joke. Do you see that? No woman had been chosen in over 500 years, only men. But then I was chosen. An impossible, cruel mistake. A mistake. The druid stared at the gardens, his face expressionless once more. There was no mistake, he responded, though Will believed he was speaking almost to himself. The druid looked back at her, turning quietly. What frightens you, Amberley? You are afraid, aren't you? She did not look up, did not open her eyes. Her head nodded once. Alanon reseated himself. His voice was gentle now. Fear is part of life, but it should be faced openly, never hidden. What is it that frightens you? There was a long silence. Will leaned forward quietly on his seat several benches away. Finally, Amberley spoke, her words whispered. She does. The druid frowned. The Elkris? But this time Amberley did not answer him. Her hands lifted to her stricken face and wiped away the tears. Her green eyes opened and she came to her feet once more. If I were to agree to travel with you to Arbelon, if I were to agree to face my grandfather and my people, if I were to go before the Elkris one final time, if I were to do all this, all that you have asked, what then if she will not give to me her seed? Alanon straightened. Then you may return to Havenstead, and I will trouble you no more. She paused. I will think about it. There is no time to think about it, Alanon insisted. You must decide now, tonight. The demons search for you. I will think about it, she repeated, her eyes settled on Will. What is your part in all of this, healer? Will started to reply, but her quick smile stopped him. Never mind. Somehow I sense that we are alike in this. You know no more than I. Less, Will wanted to tell her, but she had already turned away. I have no place for you in my home. She spoke to Alanon again. You may sleep here if you like. Tomorrow we'll talk about this further. She started toward the cottage, chestnut hair trailing sail-like down her back. Amberley, the big man called after her. Tomorrow, she replied, and did not slow. Then she was gone, disappearing silently through the cottage door, leaving Druid and Veilman staring after her in the dark. Chapter 11. The creature came for Will through the sluggish haze of his sleep, a formless creation of his dreams that rose up hauntingly out of the depths of his subconscious. It was a thing of terror, a thing that lurked in the dark recesses of his mind where he hid his deepest fears. It came for him with stealth and cunning, slipping easily past the obstacles with which he sought to block it, its motion fluid and quick as it pressed in about him. He could not see it as it came. He never would. It lacked substance or identity. It lacked reason. There was only the overwhelming sense of terror it created by its being. He ran from it, of course. Ran swiftly through the landscapes of his imagination, ran and ran until it seemed he must surely have left it behind. But he had not. It was there at once, closing swiftly, surely. He lunged from it in desperation, screaming soundlessly for help, anyone's help. But there was no one. He was alone with this thing, and he could not escape it. Yet he must, for if it were to reach him, if it were to touch him, he knew with certainty that he would die. So he ran in fear, blindly, feeling the breath of the thing hot upon his neck. He came awake with a start, lurching upward from beneath the blankets to a sitting position. The night air was cold on his face and body. Sweat ran from beneath his arms, and from within his head he could hear the sound of his heart pounding wildly. Al-Anon's dark form crouched next to him, strong hands holding fast to Will's shoulders. The druid's voice was a harsh whisper. "Quick, Veilman. They have found us." Will Ohmsford did not need to ask who it was that had found them. It was his dream become reality. He came to his feet with a bound, grabbing up his blanket and hurrying after the druid, who was already moving toward the little cottage. As if by intuition, Amberlee appeared at the edge of the porch, white nightdress blowing eerily about her slender form, giving her a ghostly appearance. Al-Anon went to her at once. "I told you to dress," he whispered angrily. She looked unconvinced. "You would not seek to trick me, druid? This would not be some game you are playing to help me make up my mind to come back with you to Arbalon?" Al-Anon's face went black. "Another few minutes of standing around and you will have your answer. Now dress." She stood her ground. "Very well, but I cannot leave the children. They must be taken to a place of safety." "There is not time enough for that," the druid urged. "Besides, they will be safer here than stumbling about in the dark."
"They will not understand being left like this."
"Remain, and they will share your fate." Al-Anon's patience was gone. "Wake the oldest. Tell him that you must go away for a time, that you have no choice. Tell him that when it is light out, to take the others to a neighbor's home. Now do as I say. Hurry." This time she did not argue, but turned and disappeared back inside the cottage. Will straightened his clothing and rolled his blanket tight. Together, Druid and Veilman saddled the horses and brought them around to the front of the darkened home to wait for the elven girl. She was with them almost immediately, dressed in boots, slacks, belted tunic, and a long blue riding cloak. Al-Anon brought the girl and the Veilman close before Artak, whispering softly to the animal, stroking the satin neck. Then he handed the reins to Will. "Get on." Will did as he was told, scrambling aboard the big black. Artak shook his head and whickered. Al-Anon continued to whisper gently, then took Amberlee by the waist and swung her up behind the Veilman as if she were no more than a feather's weight. Then he mounted Spitter. "Quiet now," he cautioned. "Not a word." They turned onto the roadway that ran in front of the little cottage and followed it eastward through the sleeping village. Only the sound of their horses' hooves thudding softly on the earthen trail broke the deep stillness. In minutes, the buildings of the village were behind them, and they were at the forest's edge. Before them stretched the tilled fields, the waters of the irrigation ditches sparkling with moonlight as they crisscrossed through neatly planted rows of grain and corn already grown and ripening. In the distance, on either side, the wooded slopes of the valley fell away into the grasslands. Al-Anon dismounted wordlessly. He stood motionless for a time, listening to the silence of the night, his dark face anxious. Finally, he stepped close to Artak, motioning for Will and Amberlee to bend close. "They are all around us." He breathed the words. Will went cold. The druid looked at him as if to measure his worth. "Have you ridden in hunts before?" Will nodded. "Good. You and Amberlee will stay with Artak. If you are pressed, give him his head. He will see you safely through this. We will ride north along the edge of the village to where the valley drops into the grasslands. Once there, we will break through their circle. Do not stop for anything. Do you understand? If we become separated, do not turn back. Ride north until you reach the Silver River. If I do not come at once, cross and ride west to Arbalon."
"What will you?" Will asked hurriedly.
"Do not concern yourself with what I might be doing," the druid cut him short. "Just do as you are told." Will nodded reluctantly. He did not like the sound of this at all.
When Al-Anon turned away, he glanced back at Amberlee. "Hold tight," he whispered, and tried a quick smile. She did not smile back. There was undisguised fear in her eyes. Al-Anon remounted. Slowly, cautiously, they made their way along the forest's edge, skirting the western borders of the village of Havenstead. Silence hung deep and penetrating across the whole of the valley. Like shadows, they slipped through the darkness of the trees, their eyes searching the night for movement. Ahead of them, the north slope of the valley began to loom up darkly through breaks in the forest. Then Al-Anon reined in sharply, motioning for them to be still. He pointed wordlessly toward the fields on their left. Will and Amberlee followed the line of his arm. At first there was nothing to be seen, only row upon row of stalks shaded dark gray in the moonlight. But a moment later, their eyes picked out the quick movement of something vaguely like an animal as it crept from one of the irrigation ditches and disappeared into the stalks of the field. They waited for a time, frozen against the trees, then started forward once more. They had only gone a short distance when, from out of the woodlands behind them, a deep, searing howl rose. Amberlee tightened her grip about Will's waist and put her head against his back. "Demon wolves," Al-Anon spoke the name quietly. "They've found our trail." He kicked Spitter's flanks firmly and urged the horse into a slow trot. Artax snorted anxiously and followed. The howl was picked up by others, and there was the sudden sound of bodies plunging through the trees. "Ride!" Al-Anon shouted. The horses lunged forward, veering sharply left from the cover of the woodlands. At a gallop, they raced along the edge of the fields, following the line of the irrigation ditch toward the break that led to the grasslands. The howling rose all about them, fierce and hungry. Huge, leaping shadows sprang above the stalks of grain and corn in the darkness on their left, crashing wildly toward them. Will bent low over Artak's neck and urged the big horse on. Before them, the pass leading from the valley came into view. Half a dozen bristling, dark forms broke from the woods ahead of them, things that were wolf-like but much larger, and with faces that appeared grotesquely human as they lifted in the moonlight, long teeth snapping. Al-Anon turned Spitter directly toward them, blue fire sparking on the fingers of one hand as it raised menacingly. An instant later the fire lanced out, burning into the pack, scattering it wildly. Spitter surged through its midst, his call shrill with terror. Artak was already past both druid and demon wolves, his sleek body leveled out as he raced for the open plains. Several dark bodies lunged from out of the fields before them, jaws snapping at the horse's legs. Artak did not slow. He caught one beast with his shoulder and knocked him spinning. The others were quickly left behind. Will bent lower, pulling Amberlee down with him against Artak's back, loosening slightly his grip on the reins. To their right, more demon wolves bolted from the trees, their howls filling the night air. Streaks of blue fire cut through them, and the howls turned to shrieks of pain. Artak ran on. Then a single, huge demon wolf appeared at the forest's edge ahead of them, running parallel to the woodland stream that fed the irrigation ditches. It lunged forward to intercept them, moving with astonishing speed, bounding through the long grass, its movements fluid and soundless. Will felt something cold and hard tighten in his chest. The beast was narrowing the gap between them too quickly. They would not escape it. He did the only thing he could think to do. He shouted wildly to Artak and gave him his head. The big black responded. From somewhere deep within, he found new strength. His stride lengthened. The beast was almost upon them, a massive dark terror that seemed to rise up suddenly out of the night beside them. Will closed his eyes and yelled one final time. Artak screamed in response. Gathering himself, the stallion hurdled the woodland stream that lay across his path. Gaining the far bank, he raced from the woodlands and fields of Havenstead into the open plains beyond. For an instant after, Will's eyes remained closed, locked tight with fear. He simply clung to Artak's neck, feeling the comforting movement of the great horse beneath him as they fled into the night. When he finally lifted his head once more and risked a quick look behind him, past Amberley's huddled form, he found that they were alone. Fire and smoke rose out of the darkness from within the valley, and the air was filled with frenzied yowling. There was no sign of the demon wolves. There was no sign of Alanon. Almost without thinking, Will reined in Artax sharply and wheeled him about. Alanon had been firm in his instructions. Under no circumstances was he to turn back. Amberley was his first consideration. She had been given into his safe keeping. She was to be protected at all costs. He glanced quickly at her child's face as it rose out of the shadow of his back, green eyes questioning. He knew what he should do. Yet he knew that the druid was still back there, probably in trouble. How could he simply leave him and go on? His indecision lasted only a moment. From out of the valley behind them galloped a terrified spitter, wiry gray body extended in full stride. Bent low over his back, black robes billowing out wildly, his dark figure silhouetted against a horizon colored red with fire, was the druid. Close behind ran the demon wolves, their shaggy forms leaping madly through the tall grass, howling their hatred of the humans who had escaped them. Will turned Artak north instantly and put his heels to him. The big black snorted and leaped ahead. The Veilman did not give him his head this time, but held him carefully in check. Their chase might be a long one, and the black's great strength was not without its limits. Artak did not fight him, but followed his lead, running easily. Will bent forward, feeling Amberley's grip about his waist tighten, her face burying itself against his back once more. A mile further on, Spitter drew abreast, his heaving body streaked with sweat and dirt, his nostrils flaring. Already he was growing tired. Will glanced anxiously at Alanon, but the druid did not look over. His dark gaze was fixed on the land ahead as he urged his horse on with small movements of his hands. The chase through the grasslands of the Silver River country wore on with grim determination. The maddened howling of the demon wolves died quickly, changing to the sound of ragged breathing, punctuated by snarls of frustration. For the fleeing horsemen, there was only the muffled whistle of the wind and the steady pounding of their horses' hooves. Through vales that cut between gently sloping hills and over broad, empty rises they ran, hunter and hunted, past groves of fruit trees, past solitary oaks and willows, past small winding streams of water, all through the silence and dark of the plains. Time slipped away without meaning. They had run nearly a dozen miles. Still, the distance between them and their pursuers remained unchanged. At last, the Silver River slipped into view, a broad ribbon of moonlit water shining out of the dark through breaks in the low hills that bounded her near bank. Will saw the river first and shouted. Artak jumped ahead instantly at the sound of his voice, moving in front of Spitter once more. Belatedly, Will sought to hold him back, but the big black would not be curbed this time. He was still running easily, smoothly, and he quickly left the tiring Spitter behind. The gap between Artak and those who came after widened further. Will was still trying to rein in the black when he caught sight of the crouching, dark forms that appeared abruptly from out of the night ahead of him, forms that were bent and twisted and covered with bristling gray hair. Demons. Will felt his stomach tighten. It was a trap. They had been waiting here, waiting in case any managed to escape from the demon wolves at Havenstead. Now they were spread out all along the banks of the Silver River, closing as the horsemen approached. Artax saw them and veered sharply left toward a small rise. 50 yards further back, Spitter followed his lead. Further back still, but closing now on the tiring animal, ran the demon wolves, howling once more. Artak gained the summit of the rise at full gallop and broke downward for the Silver River. The demons in front of him moved quickly to bar his passage. Will could see them clearly now, cat-like beasts with the faces of women, twisted and grotesque. They bounded toward the big black, mewling hideously, muzzles lifting to reveal their long, sharp teeth. At the last second, Artak wheeled sharply and circled back toward the rise, leaving the cat thing screeching with frustration. In that moment, Spitter topped the rise, stumbled wearily, and went down. Alanon tumbled to the ground in a tangle of robes, rolled over several times, and sprang back to his feet. Demon wolves came at him from all sides, but the blue fire spread from his fingers in a broad, cutting sweep that scattered them like leaves in a strong wind. Artak wheeled left again, Will and Amberley clinging desperately to his back to keep from being thrown. Screaming his hatred of the cat things that sought to trap him, he ran at them once more, parallel now to the riverbank, moving so swiftly that he was on top of them before they had time to realize what he was about. Several of the beasts reached for him, clawed limbs ripping, but he was past them almost at once, clearing their grasping talons with a mighty leap and racing away into the night. Behind him, an arc of blue fire lanced into the nearest pursuers, burning them to ash. Will glanced back once and saw Alanon still standing atop the rise, demon wolves and cat things alike closing about him from every direction. "Too many." Will heard the words scream through his brain. Fire sprang from the druid's hands, and he disappeared in a haze of smoke and dark, leaping forms. Then some sixth sense triggered within the Veilman, warning of new danger. His gaze shifted hurriedly from the battle atop the rise. From out of nowhere appeared half a dozen more of the demon wolves, racing toward Artak in great, silent bounds. Will felt a quick moment of panic. He and Amberley were trapped between the beasts and the river. Ahead of them, a dense stretch of wood blocked their passage. Behind them were the demons they had just fled. There was nowhere for them to go. Artak did not hesitate. He veered toward the Silver River. The wolves came after, soundless, fluid, black terror. Will was sure that this time they would not escape. Alanon was no longer there to help them. They were all alone. The Silver River drew closer. There were no shallows in view, only an open expanse of water too broad, too deep, and too swift for them to cross. If they were to try, Will realized, they would most certainly be swept away. Yet Artak did not slow. Whatever the danger might be to them, the big black had made his choice. He was going into the river. The demon wolves sensed it as well. Less than a dozen yards back, they threw themselves forward in a determined effort to catch Will and the elven girl. Amberley screamed in warning. Frantically, Will fumbled in his tunic for the leather pouch that contained the elf stones, not knowing if he could even use them, only knowing that he must do something. He was too late. As his hand closed about the stones, they reached the edge of the Silver River. Artak gathered himself and sprang clear of the riverbank, Will and Amberley clinging to his back. In that same instant, white light burst all about them, freezing their motion as if they had been captured in a painting. The wolves disappeared. The Silver River vanished. Everything was gone. They were alone, rising upward in a slow, steady climb into the light. Chapter 12. Before time became time recorded, he was there. Before men and women, before nations and governments, before all the history of humankind, he was there.
even before the world of fairies split in war between good and evil, fixing unalterably the character of life thereafter, he was there. He was there in that time when the world was a sacred Eden, and all living things existed together in peace and harmony. He was young then, a fairy creature himself, while the fairy creatures of the earth were just being born. He lived within gardens that had been given over into his keeping, entrusted with the responsibility of seeing that they and all the living things that dwelt within were cared for and preserved, sheltered and renewed. He had no name, for names were not needed. He was who he was, and his life was just beginning. He had not understood what he was to become. His future was a vague and distant promise whispered in the corridors of his dreams, and he could not have foreseen its reality. He could not have foreseen that his life was not to be finite in the manner of other living things, but was to extend down through centuries of lives celebrated in birth and forgotten in death, until his own became cloaked in the trappings of immortality. He could not have foreseen that all who had been born into the world with him, and all who were thereafter to be born, whether fairy or human, would fade and be lost while he alone would continue on. Nor would he have wanted to, for he was still young enough to be filled with the conviction that his world would always be as it was then. Had he known that he would live to see it all changed beyond any possible recognition, he would not have wished to survive. He would have wished to die and become one again with the earth that had bred him. It would have been an irreparable loss, for he was to become the last remnant of that fabled time that was the world in its inception, the last remnant of peace and harmony, of beauty and light that was the Eden of life. It had been decreed in the twilight of the beginning, changing forever the course of his existence, changing forever the purpose of his life. He was to become, for a world fallen from grace, a small reminder of what had been lost. He was to become as well the promise that all that had once been might one day come again. In the beginning, he had not comprehended this. There was only shock and dismay at discovering that the world was changing, its beauty fading, its light dying, that all that had been so filled with peace and harmony was to be lost. Soon his gardens were all that remained. Of all who had come into the world with him, not one was left behind. He was alone. He despaired for a time, consumed with grief and self-pity. Then the changes that had altered the land about him began to encroach upon his own small world, threatening to change it as well. He remembered then his responsibilities, and he began the long and difficult struggle to preserve the gardens that were his home, determined that this last bit of the first world would survive, though all else had been lost. The years slipped away, and his struggle wore on. He found himself aging only slightly. He found within himself power that he had not known he possessed. After a time, he began to realize the purpose for his solitary existence, that a new trust had been given him, a trust he must not abandon. With realization came acceptance, and with acceptance came understanding. For centuries, he labored in anonymity, his existence little more than a myth that became part of the folklore of the nations building about him, a fantasy told with wry smiles and smug indulgence. It was not until after the cataclysm men called the Great Wars, the final destruction of the old world and the emergence of the new races, that the myth began to gain acceptance as truth. For it was then that he chose for the first time ever to go out from the gardens into the land beyond. His reasons were carefully drawn. There was magic in the world again, and his was the highest and best magic, the magic of life. The land without was new and fresh once more, and he saw in that rebirth an opportunity to recapture all that he had known when he was young. Through him, the past and future might at last be joined. It would not come easily or quickly. Still, it would come. But he could no longer remain secluded and hidden within his gardens. He must go out from them. Contained within his small sanctuary was the seed of all that the world so desperately needed to regain. It was the trust he had first been given. He saw that it was not enough that it be preserved. He saw that it must be built upon, more, that it must be made visible and accessible. He must see that this was done. Thus he went out from the gardens that had been his home for so many centuries, traveling into the country that lay about it, a country of sweet grasslands and gently rolling hills, of shaded woodland glens and quiet ponds, all bound together by a river that was the life stream of the land. He would not travel far from the gardens, however, for they were his first concern, and their need for his protection demanded that he stay close. Still, it did not prove necessary to journey farther than he did. The country he found pleased him. He planted the seed of the first world within its heart, marking it as his own, giving to it a special radiance that made it easily recognizable, giving to its inhabitants and to its travelers, whomsoever should require it, his blessing and protection from harm. In time the new races came to understand what he had done. They spoke of him and of his land with awe and with respect. They began to tell his story throughout the four lands. The story grew with each new telling until at last they had made of him a legend. They named him after the country he had made his own. They called him the King of the Silver River. He came to Will and Amberley in the guise of an old man, appearing from out of the light, wizened and bent with age, his robes hanging about his thin frame as if he were made of brittle sticks. His hair fell about his shoulders in thick white locks. His ancient face was wrinkled and brown with sun. His deep blue eyes were the color of seawater. He smiled in greeting, and Will and Amberley smiled in response, sensing that there was no harm in this man. They still clung tightly to Artak's broad back, the black extended in full stride, unmoving in the light that held them all frozen. Neither Veilman nor Elven girl understood what had happened, yet there was no fear in them, only a deep, comforting drowsiness that immobilized them with the strength of iron chains. The old man stopped before them, blurred and indistinct in the haze of the light. His hand touched Artak's sleek face, and the black nickered softly. The old man looked at Amberley then, and there were tears in his eyes. "Child, that you were mine," he whispered. He stepped closer, reaching up to take her hand in his own. "No harm shall come to you in this land. Be at peace. We are joined in purpose, and shall be one with the earth." Will struggled to speak, and could not. The old man stepped back again, and one hand raised in farewell. "Rest now. Sleep." He began to fade, slipping back into the light. "Sleep, children of life." Will's eyes grew heavy. It was a pleasant, welcome sensation, and he did not fight it. He was conscious of Amberley's small form slumped heavily against his own, her hands locked loosely about his waist. The light seemed to draw back from them, fading into darkness. His eyes closed, and he drifted into slumber. He began to dream.
He was standing in the midst of a garden filled with incredible beauty and serenity, dazzling in its color and fragrance, so wondrous that all else that he had known in life or had imagined possible paled in comparison. There were streams shimmering silver as they flowed from out of springs hidden within the earth and spilled into quiet ponds. There were trees canopied overhead, filtering sunlight that speckled with touches of golden warmth. There were soft, sweet grasses that carpeted the lanes and walkways in emerald silk. All manner of birds flew, fish swam, and animals walked through these gardens, passed in harmony and contentment and in peace. The Veilman was filled with a sense of deep, abiding tranquility, fulfillment, and a happiness so intense that he cried. Yet when he turned to share what he was feeling with Amberley, he found her gone.
Chapter 13. When Will Ohmsford awoke once more, it was dawn. He lay in a grassy vale beneath the sheltering limbs of twin maples, the morning sun filtering down through masses of broad green leaves in long streamers of brightness that made him blink. Close by there was the faint sound of water lapping against a shore. For an instant he believed himself still within the wondrous gardens of his dream. So real had they seemed to him that almost without thinking about it he pushed himself up on one elbow and looked about hurriedly for them. But the gardens were gone. Amberley lay next to him, still sleeping. He hesitated, then reached over and shook her shoulder gently. She stirred restlessly and her eyes opened. She looked at him in surprise.
"How are you?" he asked.
"I'm fine."
She brushed the sleep from her eyes.
"Where are we?"
Will shook his head.
"I don't know."
The elven girl sat up slowly and looked about the small vale.
"Where is Alanon?"
"I don't know that either." Will stretched his legs tentatively, surprised to find them loose and uncramped.
"He's gone."
"They're all gone. Alanon, those creatures." He paused, hearing movement in the brush at the far end of the hollow. A familiar black face poked through the leaves, nickering softly. Will smiled.
"Well, at least we still have Artak with us."
The black cropped lazily at the grass, shook himself clear of the brush, and trotted over to nuzzle Will. Will stroked the sleek head for a moment, rubbing at the horse's ears. Amberley watched quietly.
"Did you see the old man?" Will asked her.
She nodded solemnly.
"That old man was the king of the Silver River."
Will looked at her.
"I thought as much. My grandfather saw him once, years ago. I don't think I was ever really sure whether he was real or not until now, though. Funny."
Artak moved off several paces and began feeding. Will shook his head. "He saved our lives back there. The demon wolves almost had us." He caught the look that crept into the elven girl's eyes and stopped.
"Anyway, I guess we're safe now." "It was like a dream, wasn't it?" she said softly. "We were floating in the light, riding Artak with nothing beneath us but the light. Then he came up to us, walking. Came out of nowhere and said something."
She trailed off as if the memory of it confused her.
"Did you see it?"
The Veilman nodded.
"And then he disappeared," she continued, speaking more to herself than to him, as if trying to recall all that had happened. "He disappeared, and the light disappeared, and then..."
She looked at him curiously.
"The gardens," he suggested. "Did you see the gardens?"
"No," she hesitated.
"No, there were no gardens. Just a darkness and a sensation I can't describe. A sort of reaching, I think."
She looked at him for help, but he just stared back at her in confusion.
"You were standing there with me," she went on. "You were standing there, but you couldn't see me.
I called to you, but you didn't seem to hear me. It was so strange.
Will hunched forward. I remember the old man and the light just as you've described them. I remember that.
When they disappeared, I remember falling asleep.
Or at least I think I fell asleep.
Anyway, you were there with me on Artak. I could feel your arms about my waist. The next thing I knew, I was standing in these gardens. I'd never seen anything like them. They were so peaceful and beautiful and quiet. But when I looked around for you, you weren't there. You were gone.
They looked at each other wordlessly for a moment.
I suppose we'd better worry about where we are now, Will said finally. He climbed to his feet and looked about again. Belatedly, he thought about helping Amberlee up, but by then she was already standing next to him, brushing leaves and grass from her hair. He hesitated a moment, then led the way through the brush surrounding them toward the sound of the water. Moments later, they stood at the edge of a lake so vast that its shoreline circled in either direction to the horizon and disappeared. Waves crested in sudden flashes of silver foam, the waters deep and clear blue in the morning sun. Groves of trees bordered its grass-covered banks, willow and elm and ash, leaves rippling softly in a light southerly wind that carried with it the scent of honeysuckle and azaleas. In the cloudless blue sky that canopied above the lake arced a brilliant, shimmering band of colors that seemed to rise from one end of the horizon and disappear into the other. Will glanced upward to fix the sun's location, then turned to Amberlee, shaking his head in disbelief. Do you know where we are? We're somewhere on the north shore of the Rainbow Lake. The old man carried us all the way down the Silver River and across the lake to wherever it is we are now. We're miles from where we started.
The elven girl nodded almost absently. I think you're right.
I know I'm right.
Will paced away excitedly and stopped at the water's edge.
I just don't know how he managed it.
Amberlee sat down on the grass, gazing out over the lake.
The legend says he helps those who need it when they travel in his land, that he keeps them safe from harm.
She paused, her mind clearly elsewhere.
He said something to me. I wish I could remember.
Will was not listening.
We should get moving. Arbalon's a long way off. But if we travel in a northwest direction, we should be able to find the Myrmidon, then follow it all the way to the Westland. That's a lot of open country, but we won't be so easy to find now. There's no trail to follow this time.
He missed entirely the look of annoyance that crossed Amberlee's face, his mind preoccupied with the journey ahead.
It should only take us about 4 days, maybe five, since we only have one horse between us. If we get lucky, we might find another one somewhere along the way, but I suppose that's asking a bit much.
It would help if we had some weapons, too. We don't even have a hunting bow. That means eating fruit and wild vegetables, I guess.
Of course we might.
He trailed off, suddenly aware that Amberlee was shaking her head in disapproval. The elven girl crossed her legs before her and sat back.
What's the matter? He asked, dropping down next to her.
You are, for one thing.
What do you mean I am? You seem to have fixed in your mind everything that happens from here on. Don't you think you ought to hear my thoughts on the matter?
Will stared at her, somewhat taken aback.
Well, sure, I haven't noticed you asking for them, she continued, ignoring him. Do you not think it necessary to ask?
The Veilman reddened.
I'm sorry. You were just making decisions that you have no right to make.
She paused and regarded him coolly.
I don't even know what you're doing here. The only reason I've come this far with you is that I really didn't have any choice in the matter. It's time to find out a few things. Why did Alanon bring you along in the first place, Will Ohmsford? Who are you? Will told her, starting with the story of Shay Omsford and the quest for the Sword of Shannara, and ending with Alanon's visit to Storlock to seek his aid in tracking the Bloodfire. He told her everything, deciding that it was pointless to hold anything back, sensing that if he were not completely honest with this girl, she would have nothing further to do with him. When he finished, Amberlee stared at him wordlessly for a moment, then shook her head slowly. "I don't know whether to believe you or not. I should, I suppose. I really don't have any reason not to. It's just that so much has happened that I'm not really very certain of anything right now." She hesitated. "I've heard stories of the Elf Stones. They were an old magic said to have all been lost long before the Great Wars. Yet you claim Alanon gave 3 to your grandfather, and he in turn gave them to you. If that much of what you've told me were true..." She trailed off, her eyes fixed on his. "Would you show them to me?" she asked. The Veilman hesitated, then reached into his tunic. He realized that she was testing him, but then he guessed that she had a right to do that. After all, she had only his word for everything he had told her, and she was being asked to place her safety in his hands. He pulled out the worn leather pouch, loosened the drawstrings, and dropped the stones in his hand. Perfectly formed, their color a deep, brilliant blue, they flashed sharply in the morning sunlight. Amberlee bent close, regarding them solemnly. Then she looked back at Will again. "How do you know these are elf stones?" "I have my grandfather's word on it. And Alanon's." She did not look impressed. "Do you know how to use them?" He shook his head. "I've never tried." "Then you don't really know whether they're any good to you or not, do you?" She laughed softly. "You won't know until you need them. That's not very comforting, is it?" "No, not very," he agreed. "Yet here you are anyway." He shrugged. It seemed like the right thing to do. He dropped the elf stones back in the pouch and tucked the pouch into his tunic. "I guess I'll have to wait and see how it works out to know whether or not I was mistaken." She studied him carefully for a moment, saying nothing. He waited. "We have much in common, Will Omsford," she said finally. She crossed her arms about her knees, drawing them up. "Well, you've told me who you are. I think you're entitled to the same courtesy." "My family name is Elicidal. Eventine Elicidal is my grandfather. In a sense, we're both involved in this because of who our grandfathers are." Will nodded. "That's true, I suppose." The wind caught her chestnut hair and blew it across her face like a veil. She brushed the strands away and looked out across the lake again. "You know that I do not want to go back to Arbalon," she said. "I know." "But that's where you think I ought to go, isn't it?" He eased back on his elbows, watching the rainbow's arc above him. "That's where I think you have to go," he replied. "Obviously you cannot go back to Havenstead. The demons will be looking for you there. Pretty soon they'll be looking for you here as well. You have to keep moving. If Alanon escaped..." He paused, distracted by the implications of that statement. "If Alanon escaped, he will expect us to go on to Arbalon, and that's where we'll find him." He looked over at her. "If you've got any better ideas, I'm ready to listen." For a long time, she didn't say anything. She just kept staring out over the rainbow lake, watching the graceful movement of the water, letting the wind blow freely across her face. When she finally spoke again, it was just a whisper. "I'm afraid..." Then she looked at him, seemed about to say something more, and thought better of it. She smiled, the first genuine smile he had seen from her. "Well, we're a pair of fools, aren't we? You with your elf stones that may or may not be what you think, and me about to do the one thing I swore I'd never do." She rose, walked away a few paces, then turned as he came to his feet behind her.
I want you to know this. I think that going to Arbalon is pointless. I think that Al-Anon is wrong about me. Neither the Elkris nor the Elven people will accept me back again because, despite what the Druid may think, I am no longer one of the Chosen. She paused.
Still, doing anything else wouldn't make much sense, would it?
Not to me, it wouldn't, he agreed.
She nodded. Then I guess it's settled. Her child's face regarded him soberly.
I just hope this isn't a mistake.
Will sighed.
If it is, we'll probably know soon enough.
He forced a thin smile. Let's collect Artak and find out. They spent the remainder of that day and all of the next traveling north and west through the grasslands of Callahorn. The weather was warm, dry, and pleasant, and the time passed quickly. Dark thunderclouds appeared to the north around noon of the first day, hanging ominously over the craggy expanse of the Dragon's Teeth, but by sunset they had blown east into the Rab and were gone. The Veilman and the Elven girl alternated between riding Artak and walking, doubling up when they rode, then both traveling afoot for a time in order to rest the big black. Artak looked fresh even after several hours of being ridden, but Will was not about to risk tiring the horse. They saw nothing of the demons that they had lost at the Silver River, but the creatures were certainly still out there and looking for them. If they were unlucky enough to be found again, Will wanted Artak ready to run. Bereft of any weapons at all, save for a small hunting knife Will carried tucked in his belt, they were forced to eat fruits and vegetables that grew wild on the grasslands. Will found the fare ample, if somewhat less than satisfying, but Amberlee seemed not to mind at all. If anything, she seemed quite pleased with their meals. She showed the Veilman a talent for discovering food where he would not have guessed food existed, pulling from the most unlikely places edible plants and roots that she readily identified and described in quite thorough detail. Will listened attentively and asked questions from time to time, finding this the one topic of conversation she seemed willing to pursue. Initially, he had tried to draw her out on other subjects, but had met with little success. So they talked of plants and roots, and the rest of the time traveled in silence. They slept that first night in a grove of cottonwood near a small spring that provided them with clean drinking water. By mid-afternoon of the second day, they reached the Myrmidon and began following it north. Up until that point, they had seen no one, but thereafter passed half a dozen travelers, some afoot, some on horseback, one riding in a small wooden cart drawn by oxen. All exchanged with them a word of friendship and a wave before continuing on their way. At sunset, they made camp along the Myrmidon, west and south of the city of Tirsis, finding shelter in a grove of white pine and willow. Using a willow branch, a length of twine, and a hook from his clothing, Will fashioned a crude fishing pole. Within half an hour, he had landed a pair of striped bass. He was cleaning the fish by the river's edge when a caravan of wagons swung into view from the south and wound its way down toward the far bank. Gaily painted houses on wheels with peaked roofs of cedar shingles, hand-carved wooden doors and windows studded with brass, the wagons flashed brightly in the setting sun. Teams of finely groomed horses pulled the wagons, their traces laced with bits of silver. Several riders kept pace, their graceful forms cloaked in silk and trailing streamers of color from their throats and from the bridles of their mounts. In spite of himself, Will stopped what he was doing and watched the strange procession approach the river, wagon axles groaning, leather harness creaking, voices calling and whistling encouragement. Almost directly across from where the Veilman sat, the caravan swung into a loose circle and lurched to a halt. Men, women, and children climbed from the wagons and began unhitching the teams and setting up camp. Amberlee appeared from the trees behind Will and joined him. The Veilman glanced over at her briefly, then followed her gaze back across the river to the gathering on the far bank.
"Rovers," he announced thoughtfully.
She nodded. "I've seen them before. The elves don't have much use for them. No one has.
He went back to cleaning the fish. They'll steal anything that isn't nailed down, or if it is, find a way to talk you out of it. They have their own rules, and they don't pay any attention to anyone else's.
Amberlee touched his arm, and he looked up to watch a tall man, dressed all in black save for a cloak and sash of forest green, accompany two older women in long, multicolored skirts and blouses as they carried water buckets down to the water's edge. As the women stooped to fill the buckets, the tall man removed a wide-brimmed hat and, with a flourish, bowed low to Will and Amberlee, his darkly tanned face flashing a broad smile through a shading of black beard. Will raised one arm and waved back cordially.
"I'm just as glad that they're on that side of the river," he muttered to Amberlee as they rose to return to their camp. They enjoyed a savory meal of fish, fruit, vegetables, and spring water, then settled back next to the campfire and gazed out through breaks in the forest to the glimmer of the rover fires as they blazed up from out of the darkness across the river. They were quiet for a time, lost in their own thoughts. Then Will looked over at the elven girl.
"How is it that you know so much about growing things? The gardens at your cottage in Havenstead, the roots and plants you found for us during our journey. Did someone teach you all that?"
A look of surprise crossed her face.
"For being part elf, you certainly don't know very much about us, do you?"
Will shrugged.
"Not really. The elven blood is all on my father's side, and he died when I was very young. I don't think that my grandfather has ever gone into the Westland. At least he never speaks about it. In any case, I guess I've just never thought that much about being part elf."
"It is something that you should have thought about," she said quietly. Her green eyes found his.
"We first need to understand who we were before we can understand who we are."
The words were spoken not as a criticism of the Veilmen, but almost in self-reproach. Will found himself suddenly wishing that he knew more about this girl, that he could find a way to persuade her to confide even a small piece of herself in him, rather than keeping it all so tightly locked away.
"Maybe you could help me gain at least a part of that understanding," he offered after a moment's thought.
There was instant doubt in her eyes, almost as if she believed that he was playing some game with her. She hesitated a long time before answering him.
"Very well. Maybe I can."
She squared herself around so that she was seated facing him.
"You must first understand that the elven people believe that preservation of the land and all that lives and grows upon it, plant and animal alike, is a moral responsibility. They have always held this belief foremost in their conduct as creatures of the earth. In the old world, they devoted the whole of their lives to caring for the woodlands and forests in which they lived, cultivating its various forms of vegetation, sheltering the animals that it harbored. Of course, they had little else to concern them in those days, for they were an isolated and reclusive people. All that has changed now, but they still maintain a belief in their moral responsibility for their world. Every elf is expected to spend a portion of his life giving back to the land something of what he has taken out of it. By that I mean that every elf is expected to devote a part of his life to working with the land, to repairing damage it may have suffered through misuse or neglect, to caring for its animals and other wildlife, to caring for its trees and smaller plants where the need to do so is found. Is that a part of what you were doing in Havenstead?"
She nodded.
"In a way. The Chosen are exempt from this service. When I ceased to be one of the Chosen and no longer felt welcome in my homeland, I decided that I should do service to the land.
Most of the work done by the elves is carried out in the Westland, because that is the elven homeland. But we believe that the care of the land is not simply an elven responsibility, but the responsibility of all men.
To some extent the dwarves share our concern, but the other races have never been much persuaded. So some of the elves go out from the Westland to other communities, trying to teach the people living there something of their responsibility for the care and preservation of their land. This is what I was trying to do at Havenstead. And you were working with the children of the village, Will surmised. Primarily the children. For the children are more receptive to what I teach and have the time to learn. I was taught of the earth when I was a child. It is the elven way. I was more adept than most at translating the lesson into use. One of the reasons, I guess, that I was selected to be a chosen. The skills of the chosen in the preservation and care of the earth and its life forms are of the highest order. The Elkris has some sense of this. She has this ability. Amberlee seemed to catch herself in the middle of a thought she did not wish to express. She stopped abruptly, shrugging. Anyway, I was very good at teaching the children of Havenstead, and the people of the village were very kind to me. Havenstead was my home, and I did not want to leave. She shifted her gaze abruptly to the fire between them. Will said nothing, leaning forward to add several pieces of stray wood to the flames. After a moment's silence, Amberlee looked up at him again. Well, now you know something of the elven feeling for the land. It's a part of your heritage, so you should try to understand it. I think I do understand it, the Veilman replied, reflecting. At least in part. I have not been trained in the elven manner, but I have been trained by the Stores as a healer. Their concern for human life is much the same as the elven concern for the land. A healer must do whatever is in his power to do to preserve the lives and health of the men, women, and children whom he treats. This is the commitment I made when I chose to become a healer. The elven girl looked at him curiously. Somehow that makes it seem even stranger that you were persuaded by Alanon to look after me. You are a healer, dedicated to preserving life. What will you do if you are placed in a situation where, in order to protect me, you must harm others, perhaps even cause them to die? Will stared at her wordlessly. He had never even considered the possibility that such a thing might happen. Thinking on it now, he experienced an unpleasant feeling of doubt. I don't know what I'll do, he admitted uncomfortably. They were silent for a moment, staring across the fire at each other, unable to break through the awkwardness of the moment. Then Amberlee rose abruptly, came over to the Veilman and sat next to him, impulsively clasping his hand in her own. Her winsome face looked out at him through the shadow of her hair. That wasn't a fair question to put to you, Will Ohmsford. I'm sorry I asked it. You came on this journey because you believed that you might help me. It is wrong of me to doubt that you would do so. It was a fair question, Will replied firmly. I just don't have an answer to it. Nor should you, she insisted. I, of all people, should know that some decisions cannot be made in advance of the time that will demand them. We cannot always anticipate the way in which things will happen, and therefore cannot anticipate what we will do. We must accept that. Again, I am sorry. You might as well ask me what decision I will make if the Elkris tells me that I am still one of the chosen. Will smiled faintly. Be careful. I am tempted to ask exactly that. She released his hand instantly and rose. Do not. You would not like the answer I would give you. She shook her head sadly. You think my choice in this is a simple one, one that you could make easily. You are wrong. She walked back to the other side of the fire and reached down for her travel cloak, shaking it out upon the ground. As she prepared to roll herself in it to sleep, she turned back to him one final time. Believe me, Veilman. Should our decisions become necessary, yours will be the easier of the two. She lowered her head to the folds of the cloak and was asleep in moments. Will Ohmsford stared thoughtfully into the fire. Although he could not begin to explain why, he found that he believed her.
Chapter 14. When they awoke the following morning, Artak was missing. At first they thought that he might have wandered off during the night, but a quick check of the woods in which they were camped and the open grasslands beyond failed to turn up any sign of the big black. It was at this point that an unpleasant suspicion began to form in the back of Will's mind. Hurriedly he examined the area in which Artak had been left to graze, moving from there along the perimeter of their campsite, dropping to his knees from time to time as he went to smell the earth or touch it with his fingers. Amberlee watched him curiously. After a few minutes of this, the veilman seemed to find something. Eyes still fixed on the ground before him, he began walking southward through the small stand of timber and into the grasslands. 100 feet, 2. He began to angle toward the river. Wordlessly, the elven girl trailed after. Moments later, they both stood at the edge of the Myrmidon, staring out across a series of shallows several 100 yards downstream from their camp. Rovers. Will spat the word out like a bitter pill. They crossed here during the night and stole him. Amberlee looked surprised. Are you sure? I'm sure. Will nodded. I found their tracks. Besides, no one else could have managed it. Artak would have called out if it were anyone but an expert horse handler, and the rovers are the best. Look, they're already gone. He pointed across the river to the spot on the empty grasslands the caravan had occupied the previous night. They stared at it silently for a moment. What do we do now? Amberlee asked finally. Will was so mad he could barely speak. First we go back and pack our things. Then we cross the river and have a look at their campsite. They returned to their own camp, hastily put together the few items they had carried with them, and returned to the river. They crossed at the shallows without difficulty. Minutes later they stood at the now deserted rover camp. Once more Will began studying the ground, moving more quickly this time as he paced the area from end to end. Finally he walked back to where Amberlee stood waiting. My Uncle Flick taught me to read signs when I hunted the woods about my home in Shady Vale, he informed her conversationally, his mood considerably improved. We used to fish and trap the Dulln forests for weeks at a time when I was little. Always thought I might again have need of what I learned some day. She nodded impatiently. What did you find? They've gone west, probably just before daybreak. Is that all? Isn't there some indication of whether or not Artak is with them? Oh, he's with them, all right. Back at the shallows, there are signs of a horse going into the river from the other side and coming out again over here. One horse, several men. No mistake, they've got him. But we're going to get him back again. She looked at him doubtfully. You mean you're going after them? Of course I'm going after them. He was getting angry all over again. We're both going after them. Just you and me, Veilman? She shook her head. On foot. We can catch up to them by nightfall. Those wagons are slow. That assumes that we can find them, doesn't it? There's no trick to that. At one time I could track a deer through wilderness timber where there hadn't been rain for weeks. I think I can manage to track an entire caravan of wagons across open grasslands. I don't like the sound of this at all, she announced quietly. Even if we do find them, and they do have Artak, what are we supposed to do about it? We'll worry about that when we catch up to them, he replied evenly. The elven girl did not back away. I think that we should worry about it right now. That's an entire camp of armed men you're talking about chasing after. I don't like what's happened any better than you do, but that's hardly sufficient excuse for failing to exercise sound judgment. With an effort, Will held his temper. I am not about to lose that
horse. In the first place, if it weren't for Artak, the demons would have had us back at Havenstead. He deserves a better fate than spending the rest of his years in the service of those thieves. In the second place, he is the only horse we had and the only horse we are likely to get. Without him, we will be forced to walk the rest of the way to Arbalon. That will take more than a week, and most of that week will be spent crossing these open grasslands. That increases rather substantially the chances of our being discovered by those things still searching for us. And I don't like the sound of that. We need Artak.
You seem to have made up your mind on this, she said expressionlessly. He nodded.
I have. Besides, the rovers are traveling toward the Westland anyway. At least we'll be headed in the right direction.
For a moment she didn't say anything. She merely looked at him. Then finally she nodded.
All right. We'll go after them. I want Artak back too. But let's think this through a bit further before we catch up to them. We had better have some sort of plan worked out by then, Veilman.
He grinned disarmingly.
We will.
They walked all day through the open grasslands, following the trail of the rover caravan. It was hot and dry, and the sun beat down on them from out of a cloudless blue sky. They found little shade along the way to relieve them from the heat. What water they carried was soon gone, and they did not run across even a small stream to replenish their supply. By late afternoon, all they could taste in their mouths was the dust of the plains and their thirst. Leg muscles ached and their feet blistered. They spoke to each other only infrequently, conserving their strength, concentrating on putting one foot in front of the other, watching the sun sink slowly into the horizon ahead of them until all that remained of the day was a dull orange glow above the sweep of the land. A short time later it began to darken, the day to disappear into dusk, the dusk into night. Still they walked on, no longer able to find the marks of the wagon wheels in the plains grass, relying now on their sense of direction to keep them moving in a straight line westward. Moon and stars brightened in the night sky, casting down upon the open grasslands their faint light to guide the Veilman and the elven girl as they moved steadily forward. Dirt and sweat cooled and dried on their bodies, and they felt their clothing stiffen uncomfortably. Neither suggested stopping to the other. Stopping meant admitting they would not catch up to the caravan that night, that they would be forced to go on like this for another day. They kept walking, silent, determined, the girl as much so as the man now, a fact that surprised him and caused him to feel genuine admiration for her spirit. Then they saw light in the distance ahead, a fire burning through the dark like a beacon, and they realized that they had found the rovers. Wordlessly, they trudged to within shouting distance of the firelight, watching the peaked roofs of the wagon homes gradually take shape in the night, until finally the entire caravan stood revealed, wound into a loose circle as it had been on the banks of the Myrmidon. Will took hold of Amberley's arm and gently pulled her down into a crouch. "We're going in," he whispered, his eyes never leaving the rover camp. She looked at him in disbelief. "That's your plan?" "I know something of these people. Just go along with whatever I say and we'll be fine." Without waiting for her response, he stood up and began walking toward the caravan. The elven girl stared after him for a moment, then rose to her feet and followed after. As they drew closer to the circled wagons, the faces of the men, women, and children passing within the firelight grew visible. Laughter and bits of conversation became audible and distinct. The rovers had just finished their evening meal and were visiting casually with one another. From somewhere within the camp came the soft thrum of a stringed instrument. 20 yards from the perimeter of the circle, Will called out. It surprised Amberley so that she jumped. Within the camp, everyone instantly stopped what was being done, and all heads turned in their direction. There was a sudden scrambling of feet as a handful of men appeared at the gap between the wagons nearest the approaching pair. Wordlessly, the men peered out into the night, the firelight behind them now, leaving them shadowed and faceless.
Will did not slow. He kept walking directly toward them, Amberley a step or two behind. The entire caravan had gone suddenly still. "Good evening," Will said cheerfully as he reached the gathering of rovers who blocked their passage into the camp. The men said nothing. In the glimmer of the firelight, the veilman caught a glimpse of metal blades.
"We saw your fire, and we thought you might give us something to drink," he continued, still smiling. "We've been walking since daybreak without water, and we're about worn out."
Someone pushed his way through the knot of silent men, a tall man in a cloak of forest green and a broad-brimmed hat, the man they had seen at the river.
"Ah, our young travelers from last evening," he announced quietly and not in greeting.
"Hello again," Will responded pleasantly. "I'm afraid we've had some very bad luck. We lost our horse during the night. He must have wandered off while we were sleeping. We've been walking all day without water, and we could use something cool to drink."
"Indeed."
The big man smiled without warmth. He was tall, well over 6 feet, lean and raw-boned, his dark face shaded with a black beard and mustache that gave his smile an almost menacing appearance. Eyes that looked blacker than the night about them peered out from beneath a lined and weathered brow that sloped into a nose hooked slightly at the bridge. The hand that came up to beckon to the men behind him was ringed on each finger.
"Have water brought," he ordered, his eyes still on the veilman. His expression did not change.
"Who are you, young friend, and what is your destination?" "My name is Will Ohmsford," the veilman replied. "This is my sister, Amberley. We're on our way to Arberlon."
"Arberlon." The tall man repeated the name thoughtfully.
"Well, you're elves, of course. In part, at least. Any fool can see that. But now you say that you lost your horse. Would you not have been wiser to stay along the Myrmidon in your travels, rather than coming straight west as you did?"
Will smiled some more.
"Oh yes, we thought about that. But you see, it's important that we reach Arberlon as soon as possible, and walking would take much too long. Of course, we saw you camped across the river from us last night, and we saw, too, that you seemed to have a number of very fine horses. We thought that if we could manage to catch up with you by nightfall, we might trade something of value for one of your horses."
"Something of value?" The big man shrugged.
"Possibly. We would have to see what it is that you propose to trade, of course."
Will nodded.
"Of course."
An old woman appeared carrying a pitcher of water and a single wooden cup. She handed these to Will, who accepted them wordlessly. With the rovers looking on, he poured some of the water into the cup. He did not offer it to Amberley, who looked at him in surprise as he ignored her completely and drank the water down. Then he poured a second cup and drank it as well. When he was finished, he handed her the empty cup and pitcher without comment.
"You know something of the way," the tall man remarked, interest showing in his dark eyes. "You know also that we're rovers, then."
"I have treated rovers before," Will said. "I'm a healer."
A quick murmur went through the assemblage, which had grown considerably since the conversation had begun, and now consisted of almost the entire camp, some 30 men, women, and children, all dressed colorfully in bright silks with woven ribbons and scarves.
"A healer? This is unexpected."
The tall man stepped forward, removed his hat with a flourish, and bowed low. Straightening once more, he extended his hand in greeting.
"My name is Cephalo. I am leader of this family."
Will accepted the hand and shook it firmly. Cephalo smiled.
"Well, you mustn't stand out here while the night grows cold about you. Come with me. Your sister is welcome, too. You both look as if you could do with a bath and something to eat."
He led the way through the crowd of rovers into the circle of the wagons. An immense fire burned at the center of the camp, a tripod, an iron kettle suspended above it. The glow of the fire reflected off the gaily painted wagons, mixing the rainbow of colors with shadows of the night. Wooden benches sat beneath the wagons, intricately carved and polished, their broad seats cushioned by feather pillows. Brass-handled windows stood open to the light, laced with curtains and strings of beads. On a long table to one side lay an assortment of wicked-looking pikes, swords, and knives, all carefully arranged. Two small boys were diligently oiling the metal blades. They reached the cooking fire, and Cephalo turned abruptly. "Well now, which shall it be first, a meal or a bath?" Will did not even glance at Amberley. "A bath, I think. My sister as well, if you can spare the water." "We can spare it." Cephalo nodded, then turned. "Eritrea!" There was a whisper of silk, and Will found himself face to face with the most stunning girl he had ever seen. She was small and delicate in the manner of Amberley, but without the childlike innocence that marked the elven girl. Thick black hair tumbled in ringlets to her shoulders, framing eyes that were dark and secretive. Her face was beautiful, her features perfectly formed and immediately unforgettable. She was wearing high leather boots, dressed in pants and tunic of scarlet silk that failed to hide anything of the woman beneath. Bands of silver flashed on her wrists and neck. Will looked at her in astonishment and could not look away. "My daughter." Cephalo sounded bored. He motioned toward Amberley. "Take the elven girl and let her bathe herself." Eritrea smiled wickedly. "It would be much more interesting to bathe him," she offered, nodding toward Will. "Just do as you're told," her father ordered sharply. Eritrea kept her eyes on the veilman. "Come along, girl," she invited. She turned and was gone.